in my job when I was in Buenos Aires during the last 6 weeks, and was not the right time to write a paper on the future of the world. I was very worried about the future of Jorge Sabato. The second remark of this, I will call it of the philosophy. One by Elio, because, no? Let's try now, is that it? No. Well, it's a complication because there is a lot of reverberation here, no? Like this? I say that, in fact, my paper would be better if we're following the one by Elio, because all you can say about what to do with science of and technology anywhere depends on what is your political approach. The science and technology is a dependent variable of the political model you have. Anyway, I have read the paper of Elio, and I will use and quote him. And by the way, I'd like to congratulate Elio by his paper. It's really one of the best I have read in the last year. The third one is, the third previous remark is, as I would say, of semantic nature. In my expose, science and technology means much more than research and development. Let's be clear on that for me, science and technology in this expose is the complete process from research and development till the full incorporation of innovation to the productive process. This is a complex process, and research and development can be a part of the process and cannot be. It depends on many circumstances. Innovations come to the productive process through very devious ways many times. Of course, research and development by itself has some objectives, for example, as a cultural value of importance for the development of society. But I'm not considering research and development from that point of view. I am considering research and development and the rest of things that make that innovation is incorporated to the productive process. The last remark is of, I would say, of a poetic nature. Yesterday I was very happy when Candido Mendes, in his wonderful speech, quoted Antonin Artaud, one of the greatest poets of this century. A few years ago, nobody would quote Antonin Artaud in a scientific meeting, because, you know, Antonin Artaud not only was a great poet, he was a champion of irrationality, in a sense. He was a surrealist. He was the man that 100 years after, or 80 years after, Lautréamont, the other big poet, was telling the world that we were all crazy, in poetic words. But more or less the message was that. Now, we listened yesterday to Mendes quoting Antonin Artaud, and all of us were very satisfied, very happy. I mean, we were not surprised anyway. Perhaps not happy, but not astonished. In a serious scientific meeting a few years ago, Antonin Artaud could never be quoted. This is a demonstration of the, about the middle of the last century, Lautréamont was given a picture of the world that everybody considered in those days that was crazy, and Augusto Comte was making a picture of the world that sounds very realistic, very reasonable, and especially very rational. After 100 years, now our meeting is in many respects, and particularly the rational model presented by Meadows, is given the reason to Lord Chamon, and I am very happy in that because I believe poets are better prophets than scientists. In fact, I remember talking with Aurelio about the Club of Rome, and I proposed to him very seriously that we need a couple of poets because history has shown that, as I say, poets have been better prophets than scientists. For example, not only Lord Chamon was better prophet than Comte, the philosopher, but all the surrealist poets in the 20s were absolutely better prophets than all the scientists in the 20s, including big scientists such as Einstein or Bohr or Heisenberg or Planck. At the same time that when Breton were written poems and manifestos telling that the world was going to be in pieces, that the thing that monstrosity we were going to see through the Second World War were going to happen, the scientists were talking a lot of nonsense about how nice are the human beings. Now, after all these previous remarks, I will go to the problem that I am supposed to discuss today, the role of science and technology in relation to the proposed model. Well, science and technology, we know, or we believe at least, that they are powerful instruments for the development of a country, provided two things. Number one, that development is the objective of the country. Number two, that the country knows how to use science and technology for development. These are very trivial things, but it's necessary to have in mind because the first thing to answer, if we like to discuss the role of science and technology, is to ask ourselves, science and technology, what for? So what are the problems to be solved where science and technology can be of help? If we don't answer that question, our position has no real importance. So I will say that to begin with the first things, or in other words, first things first, let's try to see what problems we are supposed to solve with science and technology in this part of the world. Well, I think that there is really one problem to be solved in the third world. It is the problem. And I will define the problem in the following words: the extremes of poverty, illiteracy, diseases, and dependence, which exist among two-thirds of the world population in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, must rank as the most urgent and compelling of all world problems. This is two-thirds of the world are illiterate, bad knowledge, etc., etc. We all know the description of underdevelopment, but it's important to remember that. And that we scientists in the third world, we have one problem, and we have one task. We must help to solve that problem. This is our problem. Now, we must remember that 99%, and I'm quoting Alex King, of the world science and technology and research and development is conducted in the developed world, and so it is overwhelmingly and quite naturally directed towards satisfying the market demands in those countries. Very little of the world research and development is directed to the elementary needs of the majority of the world. So the stock of science and technology and the stock of research and development we have in our hands, in our disposal, has been developed in the other world, not in our world, and for the needs, and fundamentally for the needs of the other world. This is important to remember. Again, it's a trivial fact, we all know that, but we tend to forget it, I don't know why. That, for example, in the case of the model we are discussing, Herrera yesterday made a comment on what we know about natural resources in the world is what the developed world was interested to know. In the case of Latin America, Argentina is perhaps the country with the best geological service in Nile, and I think that Herrera quoted in a book or some papers he wrote some time ago that less than 10% of the Argentine territory has been at all explored. And this is the best country in the third world, I'm practically sure. One of the reasons is because geological survey began in Argentina in the end of the last century. Argentina has, I think, was the first geological survey in all Latin America. By the way, a country very much dependent on mineral wells like Chile organized its geological survey about how long, 10 years ago? Or the School of Geology. The first School of Geology of Chile, a mineral country, we could define that, was organized 10 years ago, about that. So we are fully ignorant about many things related to, not only to the world we live, but to the resources of that world. So to solve our problem, the problem I define as our problem, to fight underdevelopment, we must remember that our point of departure is our full ignorance of that world we are trying to solve, or we are trying to help to solve. Now, how the MIT report see to the underdeveloped world? Remember, I define our problem is to end underdevelopment. This is our reason of existence as scientists, is to help our world to finish with underdevelopment. Now, if we read the report, in page 31, conclusion 2, we can read the following. There is no possibility of bringing the vast majority of those living in the developing countries up to the material standard of living enjoyed by the developed nations. This is a conclusion, page 31, conclusion 2, that Elias Aguarieve in his paper has qualified very well, in the sense of say this is not a law of nature as it looks when you read it. It's a socio-political consequence. But it's important to remember that from the model that we are examining, this is a conclusion, a strong conclusion, important conclusion, that if we accept that conclusion, this means very simply that we are out of the world, in the sense of we will never be able to catch up, or at least to arrive to reasonable catching up. And I will define afterwards what I mean reasonable. With this phrase, we are out of the business in a sense. When I mean we, I mean the underdeveloped world. It's more than that. In the same report, there are three provisional measures, I would say, proposed. For example, to achieve ecological equilibrium, the three are very dangerous to the underdeveloped world. Number one is the zero growth in developing countries. As Victor Key said yesterday, this means very simple that for the underdeveloped world, possibility for either commerce or usage of exportation and so on will decrease and not increase. And this has been seen from the underdeveloped world as one of the hopes in the future, that the natural growing of international commerce, the natural growing of wealth in the world, including the developed country, will give us the chances to get the resources we need to develop. Well, this is out of the question with zero growth, or not out of the question completely, but a lot reduced. The second one is, it says that stop uses the natural resources and taxes the uses of natural resources so that we can maintain that natural resources for the future. And the third one is a specific reward for recycling. For example, I read the other day that some senators and member of the House of Representatives of the United States are beginning to use recycled paper as one way to show that they are fighting against the bad uses of raw materials. So this reward for recycling and It's not coming in the future. It's already there, and taxes are being proposed, and prices, rewards are being, I remember, a campaign made by one big company in the United States, Reynolds, I think, of how to use aluminum scrap, and showing how Reynolds was beneficial to the good of the U.S. society, recycling aluminum that before were discarded. So now we have, I would say, our objective, for one side, we have our objective to help end with underdevelopment, the reason of our life, in a sense, the raison d'être, everyone concerned with this, with our world. And the other side, we have a proposition or a conclusion saying that possibility is that thing is not possible. I think this is the thing we really must first of all tackle, to see what we can do with science and technology. So it means that, to put it in a more synthetic way, it means that for the MIT report, the important problem, and Aurelio yesterday said very clearly, is that we must realize that there is only one Earth. And this was put it very dramatically, and I accept that as a very well, very clear way of putting the thing. There is only one Earth, and this is a finite Earth. It is not limited. And so we must do everything necessary to use that Earth in the most reasonable way. Well, for us, from this side of the world, we say that our problem is not only in this unique Earth, there are two worlds. Not only, not one, but two. If we accept to discuss the problem of one Earth as being the Earth of everybody, I'm sorry, but we are being misled by this way of thinking. We have two worlds that one opposed to the other. They are not two worlds in a fraternal existence. We are fighting one world against the other. It happens that during many, many years and decades, we were defeated by the other world, and now, for the first time, we are beginning to make the other world afraid of what is going to happen. And this is very important to have in mind. So I will say the following. For us, it's not a problem of one Earth or not, it's a problem of one world or none. We arrive to the conclusion of one world for everybody, now we can become rational and discuss how to use the Earth. I refuse to be rational discussing ecological equilibrium before discussing socio-political economical equilibrium. In a sense, humanity is not an emotion attitude. It's very rational and based in history. Based in history in the following way. When humanity has discovered a demand that the humanity is willing to follow, civilization has fallen in pieces. And I must remember to all of you what happened with the Roman Empire. And I suppose Candido can give all kind of information on that. He's expert on that. But the Roman Empire was really the vertex of a tremendous civilization compared with the barbarians surrounding the Roman Empire. The difference between the Roman Empire and the barbarians, any one of the barbarians, were absolutely bigger than the difference between today, between United States and South Vietnam. Where the difference was bigger, more civilized in comparison with the Roman Empire, Rome, and any one of the poor tribes living there in Germany or in France. But once something, a new ideal was put in the society, in the humanity in those days, the Roman Empire was destroyed. And in fact, the humanity, in matter of civilization, went back several hundred years. And the humanity chose that way to do it. I don't think it was a rational thing. It was the mood of the time. As the Germans say, the Zeitgeist of the time was that. Well, my point of view is the zeitgeist of today is one world or none. Holocaust is preferred than slavery. We perhaps suppose that this is completely rational. Well, I don't care if it is rational or irrational. I mean, this is what the world is chosen, really, and will choose. Holocaust is preferred than slavery. And we have concrete examples every day in all over the world. Not to quote the very much quoted war in South Vietnam. So, my point of view is that for the underdeveloped world, socio-political disequilibrium, socio-political, economic, and disequilibrium is more important, more urgent than ecological. Now, how the developed world, see, the developed world is worrying with ecological equilibrium for reasons that are very clearly explained in Jaguarive's paper. But the important thing I like to quote from Jaguarive is what is the strategy of the developed world with the problem of the ecological equilibrium. Jaguarive would say, and I quote, and I agree with his conclusion, fundamental conclusion, and I will elaborate from that conclusion on. Perhaps in the afternoon we arrive to the conclusion that this conclusion is not right. Well, I must change the thing I say. But I believe that this is the real one. Jaguarive would say the following, that confronted with various forms of ecological scarcity, I mean the problem of ecological equilibrium, the imperial center and the developed nations and groups will reserve all or most of the scarce facilities for their own use, whereas imposing to the rest of the world, that means us, the restrictive policies on demographic, economic, and technological expansion required for restoring the world ecological equilibrium. That means us. The world ecological equilibrium is a problem for the developed world. The world ecological equilibrium will be restored following this strategy. In such conditions, follows Jaguarive, except if very timely and efficient measures are able to reestablish the ecological balance and to prevent the future scarcity of natural resources, it hardly seems to be possible to prevent that attempt by the superpowers and dominant groups to ensure their own survival in selfish ways at the expense of the rest of the world do not bring about the socio-cultural disintegration of contemporary society. This is this description, as Jaguarive would say, is the one that Candido was yesterday when he was talking about Holocaust and hecatombs and the work falling in pieces. Now, so we have a strategy vis-a-vis the problem of the world ecological equilibrium from the world power, the imperial centers, as Jaguarive said. We say, from the other side, we don't have a strategy, or we don't have a strategy for the socio-political economic equilibrium. We have a target is to try to end with that. Now, I accept the fact that everything that has been exposed here and discussed here show us that the world is the earth is a finite earth, that we are going to have problems of resources, and 50 years, 60 years, I don't know how many years, depends very much the span of time. If we are talking of 100 years, the problem is of complete different nature if we are talking about 50 years. But anyway, I agree that we do have a problem there, and that we must try to help to solve it. But remember the following, and this is a very important thing. The developed world is really deeply and more deeply concerned day and day with a world ecological equilibrium. There's plenty of studies and plenty of work going on this in several places. Well, I must say the following. It's the first global problem that the developed world cannot solved without the underdeveloped world assistance. It's the first global problem that the developed world cannot solve without the underdeveloped world cooperation. It's like Sunker said yesterday, wait a minute, there is India and China, and this is a fourth of humanity. Will depend very much on the behavior of India and China, what is going to happen with the ecological equilibrium. So something that is happening now in India is going to have influence on how the Americans are going to live, not how the Indians are going to live. And this is a very important difference with the past. With the past, the Americans were worried, or the Russians, it's the same for my argument, were worried about how the Indians were to live in matter of, it was a kind of charity, or kind of, I would say, the strategy of political power. To have a good ally in India was necessary to give a bit of help to the Indians. If not, the Indians would go to the Russians, and the Russians make the same reasoning. But in fact, were not very important finally. But now, through all this study, I was very happy to read all this, because it happened that what happens in India, maybe it's going to kill somebody in Russia, or in England, or in West Europe, or in the United States. Or now, the problem is completely different. It's like having cholera in Pakistan can kill the Americans in New York, not only in Pakistan. So it's not a problem now of being good for the sake of being good. You must be good, because if not, you are not going to survive. So I must say the following. For the first time, the underdeveloped world, realize or not, has a weapon, has a counter-violent power, has something to threaten the other part of the world. And this is a war. Let's put it clearly. It's a real war between one world and the other. So in this world, our world needs weapons, and this is a weapon. And it's a very interesting weapon, because we can use this weapon by the simple fact of refusing to do, for example, birth control. And we are going to die, don't care, you are going to die also. Is the World Bank worried about world control because of development? No, sir, it's not because of development, I'm very sorry. It's because the World Bank, the society that World Bank represents is going to die if we don't do birth control. So I refuse to do birth control. You say, you are suicide, Sabatos. Well, it's possible. It's possible that I prefer to commit suicide if with this I can kill you in this war. Remember, this is a war. All these things I am explaining are not rational, of course. It's not, nobody's doing an analysis of this by reason. This is what people is going to react. This is the important thing. So, I must say the following. From the underdeveloped world, I must confess I am happy, very happy, with the prospect that you have put it in the blackboard. Because I think that we are going to perish together. And this makes me really more happy than 2 years ago, that the only ones who are going to perish were ourselves. Now, let's go now back to the role of science and technology. Let's go back to the role of science and technology, because I will say the following. After this analysis of the two worlds, and the two objectives, I must propose something that be of constructive nature after all this description. All this has been practical description. Well, I have something concrete and constructive to propose. I think that what we need to do, and this is going to be the role of science and technology now, is what we need to do is try to get that world, one world that we need, through the fear that the Earth is finished. I mean, let's use the fact that the equilibrium, ecological disequilibrium, is the one thing that is worrying the other part, to say to them, let's put it together here, let's
let's agree that we are going to fight to help in the war against ecological disequilibrium if socio-political economic disequilibrium is finished at the same time. I don't think these are two stages. I think I look to the problem as one, and I will put some examples. I will repeat it if I was not clear on that. I mean, we have the problem of ending with socio-political, economic, and disequilibrium. This is from our side, from the side of the third world. From the other side, they have the problem of ending with ecological disequilibrium. Let's agree that we are going to help them on that if they help us on this. And this will put the problem of socio-political, economic disequilibrium and the so-called aid and help in the right perspective. Till now, you know that help and aid have been peanuts, really peanuts. It's practically nothing. Nothing compared with the actual world existing in the world. I mean, when you compare how much money is given to help in help or aid, in all the, using all the mechanisms for help, direct and indirect, multilateral, bilateral, are peanuts compared with $200,000 million per year expended in armament. So it's against that figure that you must compare. Not because that figure, we can be against or in favor of that figure, that gives you an idea of the world. The world is so rich that can expend $200 million a year, $200,000 million a year in armament. Every year, next year, $200,000 million, etc., etc. So this is how rich is the world. How much is expended in all kind of help everywhere, from the communist world, from Russia, from the United States, everybody all together is of the order. I don't remember the figure of last year. I used to have it about 3 years ago. But it's of the order of $12,000 million. $12,000 million against $200,000 million. So this gives you a clear idea that we have all the resources necessary, all the money, all the capital, if you like it. We are spending only $12,000 million instead of $200,000 million. So we can really sit around the table with the other part and agree with that. All right, we will be rational, we will fight, we will control versus control, we will explode more rationally all our natural resources, and we will fight pollution, we will not use GDP anymore, and we will not put mercury in the fish to kill the fish, and so on, everything you like. But please agree that this is a deal, and this is a fair deal, to end with the social, political, economic disequilibrium. This sounds very much as an utopia. I don't care if it sounds so. I think that this is a realistic way of putting the problem. Now, in the case of science and technology now, the case of science and technology, my one way of seeing the problem is that if all of us are going to be now members of the club, not the club of Rome, the club of the world, because we have agreed on that we are going to do our job and we are going to help you in that, provided you help us in this, we will say we have something to say, including in how we are going to use our natural resources and how we are going to control and exploit nature. Remember that till now, the exploitation of nature has been absolutely the responsibility of the developed world. Absolutely. We have been only the exploitees, or how do you say, is it us? We gave nature, and we really were the ones who exploited nature, not us. So if in this moment God is going to judge what is happening with pollution and what is happening with the scarcity of no natural resources, if God exists, God will say simply, will simply see a fact that we were absolutely innocent. We were there, and the good white man came to exploit and natural all the resources that we have. So we require to have a voice in the future exploitation of the natural resources. And to have a voice, to have a voice in that, that is not only a political problem, it's not only an economic problem, it's a scientific and technological problem. And then I arrive then to the problem that we need to build up a scientific and technological indigenous capability to be intelligent participants in the uses, in the control of nature and the exploitation of nature, instead of being witness, silent witness, innocent witness. We must be involved. To be involved, we need to have a scientific and technological capability of our own. And to have that, we need the help. We need the help. We cannot do it by ourselves. What we have been trying to do in the last 15 years, fighting as mad, to increase our capability in practically nothing. It's really a fight that we cannot fight alone. We're going to fight it alone if the need is there. But this is a typical case where we need a tremendous help. With a clear objective, it's a tremendous help to build up a scientific and technological capability, indigenous capability, to be able to participate, to fully participate in the control and exploitation of nature. I will finish saying the following. We have global problems to be analyzed and studied from the scientific and technological point of view. Using my proposal of not making independent ecological equilibrium from socio-political economical equilibrium, I will say the following. If we make it independent, I know what is going to happen. Every scientist in the third world in the next 10 years will begin to study the problem of pollution and the problem of what to do with the copper, and forget what to do with diseases, illiteracy, underdevelopment, and so on. Because it will be the mood. As it was the mood 10 years ago to study nuclear physics, would be the mood to study things like the one we are discussing today. But we can combine, with the approach I am proposing, we can see every problem in an authentic global nature. Global not only because it's ecological, but because it's also socio-political, economic. And these are the problems we must, as scientists, be involved. For example, you take the problem of any one of the so-called global problems. Say, for example, earthquakes. Earthquakes is a problem of controlled nature. It's a problem that we know that for the first time in humanity, it can be attacked in a global way, not only as a technical, scientifically technical thing, but also as a political thing, because we need to go to boundaries all over the world to have the possibility of early detection of earthquakes, and possibly the possibility of deviating earthquakes to the good uses of atomic weapons. It's not a dream, it's a possibility. Sometime in the future, I would say, but a clear possibility. Now, this is a problem that for the underdeveloped world, it's a problem not only for the developed world, it's a problem for the developed world. Unfortunately, the history has been a bit cruel on that. Every earthquake important, after the San Francisco one and the Tokyo one, when San Francisco and Tokyo were underdeveloped, has happened in the underdeveloped world. The important earthquake, Chile is an example of earthquake, and Turkey was another one. So it's a preference there, the earthquake. But now I would say the following, that the global approach to exploitation and control of nature, taking into account all the variables that are involved in the problem, and not only the one that we are called that we call ecological variable, but the other ones. This is where we must be involved if we build up that scientific and technological capability. But what I imagine how we can build up that scientific and technological capability is through this problem. It's not before we are going to build up and then we are going to use it. What I am
I would like to propose is that from now on, all these global problems that are global, ecological, socio-political, economical, are attacked by scientists, technologists, and the rest, with the capability available for everyone, that everyone has available, but this will help to develop and to increase the capability. I mean, some people imagine that this is a static process. First, we try to build up here in Brazil or in Argentina a capability. Then we are going to use it in the world. My proposal is completely the other way around, that we begin to use the capability in spite of how small is that capability. Because this is going to develop an attitude, this is going to develop a new language, this is going to develop a new way of looking the world at one. This is why I think that the building up of the scientific technological capability must be through international cooperation, but attacking problems that are international importance altogether, like the program of the Quiet Sun some years ago, that in a sense was an static program, was the sun, the Quiet Sun, and all the phenomena related. But one year after, the year of the Quiet Sun ended, it was a good example of collaboration, was nothing that was related to the other problems, the actual problems of society. So, I'm sorry to, I have time, two minutes more. Well, but I will take another five minutes. Proposal that is of a general nature, I like to follow with one of the practical nature for the Club of Rome. For the Club of Rome, my proposal is the following. We have been working with a model that in a sense it's like the models in mechanics. That means in mechanics, when you study mechanics, for example, movement of planets or satellites, you have the original, the data of today, you have the set of differential equations, you figure out how this is going to happen for one parameter or two or three, and you have the new equation for example, the path of the comet or the satellite. This is a typical mechanical approach. I think there is another approach to study the world. It's what I will call the thermodynamic approach. The thermodynamic approach is the following. It's the one that you choose one variable, and you say, this is the variable that the humanity or the world is interested in. It's the zeitgeist, if you like. For example, equality. Suppose I say, what humanity is looking for is equality. So this is the variable to be maximized. Let's describe the state of the world in 20, 40, or 50 years' time with equality maximized. Not with a state as it is today, but maximized. Maximized in one way, you can define many ways of relative maximums and so on. You can see this as a process. In 20 years, your inequality will be divided by 10, in 40 years by 25, or by 50, and so on. The important thing is this is a process. Humanity knows that this is a long process. It was a long process to finish slavery, and there was a long process in history to finish with the feudal system. It's a long historical process, it doesn't take place in 20 years. But the important thing is if we are going in that direction, and I suppose that is the direction that humanity is chosen to go. And I call that method thermodynamics because this is how you describe the world in thermodynamics. You have the initial state, you have the data of the initial state, and you say about the final state, the entropy will be maximized, so you will describe how the world is going to behave from here to the final state, maximizing entropy. Now,
For example, we can take yesterday we talked about regional studies. Remember? Well, my proposal would be for the Club of Rome to take Latin America as a regional study, but instead of going through the mechanics, in fact, as happens with mechanics and thermodynamics, they are not opposite, they are not either divergent. In fact, my thermodynamic proposal can be very much worked with a lot of the techniques developed by the MIT system, of course. But my proposal would be, instead of studying the region, Latin America, this point of view, let's analyze the ecological, ecological problem in Latin America from the point of view of maximizing the social equilibrium, instead of the other way around. Let's describe the state of the world in 20 years' time with a certain achievement in matter balancing, getting a better social, political, economic equilibrium, and look to the ecological context. So then we will understand how much price we are going to pay for that equilibrium we are seeking. And another important thing, sir, is that from the point of view of science and technology, clear objectives will come from that study. Because if we discover that if we like to have inequality in 30 years' time decreased by half, or decreased by 20%, then once we put that as our target, then we figure out what happens with the natural resources, pollution, population, and so on. And we see that, we discovered that our incompatibility, because we have imagined that the point of view of resources were a continuous development. But as we put that target of decreasing inequality by half, then we discovered that we need to have here a jump in something. We need to have a jump in, for example, in power, in electricity. I will say from there come a clear objective for science and technology to be solved. As that objective target cannot be changed, we need, with the use of science and technology, do the necessary things to provide the discontinuity necessary so that we can arrive to that target. I'm sorry, I have been very confused and as I say, not very precise, but I hope that anyway some ideas are on the floor now to be discussed in the next hour or so. Thank you very much, sir.